Even though the chemical companies would have us believe otherwise, I'm going with the Rodale Institute, which was formed in 1947 and built upon the concept that any natural system properly managed could be productive while increasing its capacity into the future. Elaine Ingham, Rodale's chief scientist, also synonymous with compost tea and restoring natural growing systems worldwide, is indeed embracing this model. If you aren't a farmer, her inspirational work will at least be something to share, if not get the alchemist in you to make some tea and plant a seed. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. It is important to talk about the whole organic word, because people do feel like oftentimes, oh, we've got it covered, or this food is organic, therefore it's going to be that much better for me, when actually that's not true at all.
It's, it kind of depends on what aspects of organic you are really looking at benefit, because the organic food is always going to be better than the conventional, because we don't have the pesticide residues in the organic. If nothing else, you're not going to develop the toxic loads of the pesticide residues that you accrue when you're eating chemically grown food. At least the organic, you can be assured that we're not going to have those levels of those pesticides in that food. Now, does the organic food actually contain the really good nutrient content that it could have? So there's the iffy part about the organic world, because especially when we're dealing with some of the larger organic growers, they're organic by substitution. They're not organic by really building their soil and having the life in the soil that the soil needs to have in order to get the nutrients into the plant and us get the nutrition that we want when we consume those foods. So I think organic is always better, or, you know, it's not just organic. It's going to be any system that's grown without the pesticides and without the inorganic fertilizers is going to be better than conventional.
Of course, and we all know it's better in the long run for the earth, needless to say. Mm-hmm. But let's move back for a moment. Last we spoke with you on Tributaries, it was quite a while ago, and you had recently been working with the California strawberry growers, showing them that the non-chemical means to higher yield was actually a reality. And I'm wondering, are they still working with these changes, and did it have a lasting effect?
And, there are quite a number of growers who are still using this kind of approach. They tend to be a bit pragmatic. When they see a problem starting to develop where they haven't managed the strawberries such that the biology in the soil, the healthiness of the plant is taking care of the problems, when something's slipped a little bit, they'll go back and use the chemicals. So those sorts of folks are not certified organic. If they, you know, just made a little bit more effort, they certainly could be. But I think a lot of the strawberry growers are starting to adopt much more biological practices, especially the smaller scale growers. It's the larger scale ones that still are on the industrial agriculture mode.
Yes, it's
and it's just too hard for them to change their ways, or, you know, they're too deeply in relationship with the chemical companies. They don't want to lose those, Christmas vacations in Hawaii benefits. So, I think a lot of them have adopted. Maybe not all of them are certified organic, because when they mess up, they still want to be able to go back and get a chemical spray that takes out the aphids or takes out the gray mold that's attacking the strawberries, you know, the day before they want to sell them. So, you know, some of that is happening where people are intermediate.
I see, yes. Well, now you are chief scientist with the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania. What's your project there now? Is there one, or do you have many in the hopper at one time?
I have many in the hopper at one time, and it just gets a little bit
hoppier.
Crazy this time of year when, you know, somebody walks in at 6 o'clock in the morning and says, did you forget, but we're supposed to spray extract today? Oh, no, I forgot. And, you know, it's a scramble to find people and hands to get things done. But most of the time, I remember what we're doing. So, of course, here at Rodale, we have the 32-year farming systems trial that's going on. So we're in our 33rd year. And that's a comparison of two different ways of doing conventional agriculture and four different ways of doing organic agriculture. I mean, I always love it when people take the, you know, seem to have an attitude that, well, organic farming is this, and conventional farming is this. When, of course, it's there's 100 different ways to grow things conventionally, and equal number, if not more, number of ways to grow things organically. And you have to know the crop, you have to know what the problems with the land are, and, you know, work to get the best crop possible under both any condition that you're trying to grow plants. So we have a number of different ways of being organic or conventional that we're comparing in the FST. Over the last 32 years that we've been doing this, when we look at the sum of the data over all 32 years, organic growers always come out ahead because they're not paying the costs of the chemical fertilizers, the pesticides, all of the things that have to go into managing that chemical system. So on an annual basis, an organic farmer, and you have to remember we're doing corn and soybean and wheat for the most part, a few additional rotation crops when we're dealing with the organic systems. But when you look at the take-home profit, if you're dealing with somebody, organic person, we're looking at $42,000 of profit in the pocket of the organic grower, while the pocket of the chemical grower, they're only going to have $22,000 in profit.
Yes, it's a long-standing myth about the opposite being true. I know, and I started on my dad, who was an apple farmer in 1970, and he just, you know, his whole argument was there's not enough yield that would happen if you go organic. And so from all the way back then to now, it's still kind of trying to climb out of that mythology. And I think one thing you could share with us right now, I'm sure you have a million stories at this point, but I loved hearing about your program to improve drought resistance, because that there are many avenues that we can go down from this beginning. And it was about the Australian farmers and reducing water need by 70%. What was that project?
Yeah, we've worked with a number of different crops in Australia, in South Africa, in the United States, in the, you know, Colorado, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, you know, you name it. We've probably worked, we have growers that we work with in every state in the U.S. But what we're looking at, reducing water use, and by some really massively significant amounts, you know, a 70% reduction in the amount of water used in some of these agricultural systems in Australia. It's just a godsend to be able to grow the crops with a lot less water. One of the instances in Australia is a series of agricultural systems that we were working with, grape systems. I'm trying to turn off my... There we go. The radio was annoying. We were working with grape growers, and where we could go in and establish the right set of biology around the root system. So basically with these growers, it meant putting in a composting yard, finding the starting materials, getting the turners, getting the water wagons, applying the compost out underneath the rows of grapes. And then a compost extracts going onto the plants three times in the early part of the growing season, where there was actually moisture falling from the sky, which is a bit rare in Australia, in the part of Australia that these farms were. And when we had water, getting the compost extract down, and then a couple applications of compost tea. So we reduced right there. We reduced the number of times these people were out in the vineyards applying anything as compared to the conventional system. And in this particular instance, we got like 3 rainfalls in the springtime, and that was it for the whole entire year. Most other places in Australia, they could not make a crop of grapes because they didn't get enough moisture. Those farms failed. Probably 95% of the table grape production in Australia failed in that year, and yet this farm had normal levels and just made a massive amount of money because they were about the only place that had table grapes to sell in the whole of Australia, and they could charge a premium amount of money for the grapes that they had. So made a lot of money. They bought several other farms based on, and of course they converted all of their farms to the biological approach. Now that's grapevines, and people who are growing vegetables or turf tend to turn off when you talk about grapevines, because what way could a grapevine system be like their pasture? Well, we've done this also with pastures, dairy farmers in Australia, down in the area around Melbourne. We work with Camperdown Compost down there. They had been making compost. It was too expensive for most of their growers to come and buy it and transport the material back to their farm. So they started making compost on each of their growers' farms. And so they were taking the waste material from the farmer's own property, turning it into something beneficial, so they didn't have manure pits anymore. They didn't have that horrible smell. They didn't have horrible levels of nitrates going back out on their property. Just some huge improvement right there. But, again, in a drought year where other people were losing their dairies, they were going bankrupt, they weren't able to pay their bills, the people that we were working with in those dairies reduced their costs by $200,000 on a 300-acre farm in the first year that we worked with them. And every year since, they've reduced the cost on their farms by about $50,000 every year succeeding. And, of course, they were growing beautiful grass on basically no measurable rainfall at all. They were basically growing grass on the dew that would fall in the mornings. And that was all the moisture that they really needed. And they actually increased their herd sizes typically about 15%. So moisture, not a problem. Reduce water use, absolutely. And what's the trick? What are we really doing? We're rebuilding soil structure. If you're using toxic chemicals, you're killing the organisms that build structure in the soil. You're killing the things that make the structure to hold the water in your soil. If you don't have structure, then the water either goes right through or it evaporates off the surface because you don't have enough plant growth on the surface to protect your soil. Soil is a nice dark brown color. If that's out in the hot sun, you're losing all of the moisture because of evaporation. Cover that surface with some nice waxy-leaved plant material, with your grasses, with whatever you're growing, and you protect that soil surface from that evaporation. And because of that, you hold more moisture in the water, or hold more moisture in your soil. There are a number of publications on this now. The people at Washington State University of Washington have been publishing on this for, probably the last 15 years, showing that a lot of the initial papers that tout you've got to remove all of the plant material because plants blow off all of this water, you've got to hold water, so you've got to have an absolutely bare surface. Those scientific reports have been proven to be just a load of chemical companies trying to convince you to buy their herbicides and flawed research. But that has been, that research has been constantly thrown in my face by chemical representatives when they want to say, oh, no, you don't know what you're talking about, Elaine, because we have scientific proof that if plants are growing out here, it's blown off all your water.
Well, they have more nerve than I do after reading and following what you've been doing for so many years. I wouldn't have the nerve to say that to you.
Well, I've gotten better and better at being able to come back at them because, of course, the first time they said that to me, it was like, okay, well, where are these scientific papers? Can I see them? Can I read them?
Right.
And when I finally got my hands on them and started reading through the methods and just, you know, started laughing.
Right. I can see you in your living room walking around ranting and raving.
Yeah. Just kind of going, my gosh, why did anyone ever believe the results from these papers?
Yeah.
Yes, if you choose the worst weeds, the things that have no leaves to speak of, all of their effort is to produce billions more seeds. Yeah, sure, they blow off all the moisture in your soil, but it's very easy to choose for other plants growing in those systems. And, of course, you would choose something that would have nice, broad, waxy leaves that wouldn't blow off any water at all to speak of. As long as you're growing plants, what we're talking about applies. And I don't care if it's corn or wheat or tomatoes or vegetables or old-growth trees or, you know, whatever. All of this applies.
The no-tilling method, I believe, could really make a difference in itself.
It kind of goes hand-in-hand with the last answer where we're talking about reducing drought problems, where we're holding and keeping more of the water in the soil. When you go and till, you, of course, destroy all the structure. You destroy the life. You're only left with bacteria in your soil, and bacteria alone can't rebuild that structure. So tillage is such a destructive way of managing your soil. And really what you want to think about is maintaining a permanent cover crop on your fields. And if you have to go and put seed into the ground, well, direct drilling is much less destructive way of putting your seed into the ground. Or if you don't have the ability to do direct drill, if the seeding that you're going to do doesn't really lend itself to direct drilling into the ground and just punching a hole where you're going to drop the seed down, then go along and do just a slit, just a, you know, very small slice, drop your seed in, and then let those seeds come on up. If it's a seed that really doesn't compete well with the plants that you've got out in your field, then you would just till a strip wide enough so that the seeds will germinate, pop up, and start shading your understory plant species. So the choice of permanent growing plants in your field is really very important. You want to choose things that are very low growing, things that have broad, waxy leaves that will always protect your soil surface. We need to get away from tilling. Of course, when you go back in time and you think about the history of agriculture, when you had to tie yourself up to the animal and to the plow, and you had to provide the physical force to push the plow down into the ground, we didn't till that often because it's just such a physically demanding thing to do. We plowed once. Put your seed in the ground, and that would be the only time you would till that soil at all. You would come along with a hoe. You and your kids would go out and pull the weeds if you got any. And if you've managed your soil right so you have all of the sets of microorganisms to support your plant, then the weeds don't grow anyway. The weeds are the things that will be sick, unhealthy, and unhappy. Your crop plant will be able to outcompete them very easily. Today, with the advent of the mechanical tractor, when you can just jump on your tractor, turn that motor on and vroom, vroom, how many times a year do growers today go till their soil? And it's way more than once. I even look at organic farms that I'm working with right now. They're tilling 5-6 times in a growing season, constantly destroying the very organisms that would prevent you having to use those toxic chemicals.
Elaine Ingram and compost tea are very synonymous these days. I know your soilfoodweb.com is a place where people can go and learn more about this and get in touch and get your help. Maybe you could just share a little bit about why compost tea is such a great idea and the fact that it's fairly simple to implement.
Right. So, you know, as Dr. Elaine Ingram, the person who really started doing the science behind these liquid forms of compost. Compost can be difficult to get put on your system it's a solid. How do you get it out there? It's a little bit difficult. It maybe costs a little bit more money than many growers want to consider. So take your small amount of compost and convert it into a liquid form. An extract is where we're just pulling those organisms that are in that compost out into the water. And then we apply it fairly rapid, fairly easy to produce. It takes few, you know, a half hour, maybe an hour to make a couple hundred gallons. But those organisms aren't active. They're not really excited and growing. So it's great to put an extract down on the soil where you need to put back into your soil these very necessary microorganisms. You want the bacteria and fungi, good guy fungi, not the bad guys. We want the protozoa and the nematodes that eat the bacteria and fungi and release nutrients in a plant-available form. Normal, natural nutrient cycling. We have to emphasize to growers that their soils already contain all the nutrients that their plants require. There is no soil in the United States where you should be putting on inorganic fertilizers. Your soil already contains hundreds of years' worth of plant growth of every nutrient that plant requires. It's already in your soil. What we're lacking is the biology to convert those nutrients that are in your soil into a plant-available form. If you kill those organisms, then you are dependent on the inorganic fertilizers. If you ever want to get off that chemical addiction, you have to put the biology back into your soil, get this normal nutrient cycling process occurring, making sure that you have enough and the right balance of these organisms so that you don't have to be buying that expensive material and putting it on your soil.
Elaine, what do you think about the sea solid minerals that are being used to remineralize soils, basically the work of Dr. Maynard Murray from back in the 40s, I believe?
And I think where you have destroyed the biology, it's not there, then, yeah, putting out sea salts is probably way less expensive and in more properly balanced than any of the inorganic fertilizers where you're only going and you're only putting back in maybe one or two or three of the nutrients that your plant might require. Plants don't grow by nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium alone. They've got to have all of those nutrients in the proper balances, and sea salt has that better balance. But if we can get the biology back into the soil, so use a compost, extract the organisms, put them back into your soil, and get that life functioning again in your soil, then you don't even need the sea salts because the nutrients are already present in your soil. It's a good step in the right direction, but ultimately you want to be not putting on any inorganic anything. They should be able to function on their own once you bring them back to a condition of health.
Elaine, is there a common practice you see being implemented by folks trying to do a chemical-free garden that you'd like to say, please don't, or maybe X would be a better use of time and energy?
I'd really like to have people make certain that they're making good compost. It needs to stay aerobic. When you're making your compost pile, be using a thermometer to find out what the temperature is so it doesn't get too hot. If the temperature of your pile is climbing above 165, 170, you're probably going anaerobic. You may not actually be able to detect it on the outside of the pile. It's the middle of the pile. So stick your thermometer in the middle, see what the temperature is, and as you pull your thermometer out, smell the bottom of that thermometer. If you've got any of the bad anaerobic smells, you know, the sulfur, the ammonia smells, the vomit, the vinegar, the sour milk smells, if you have any of those bad smells, you really need to turn the pile to get oxygen back in there. Now, when you're going to turn that compost into a liquid form, just extract the organisms and apply the organisms onto your soil. The only time we need to make tea, where tea is made by extracting the organisms and then adding food at the beginning of that brewing process. And if you add food into that liquid form, you have to aerate it. You've got to have air bubbling through there. Don't overdo the foods. More is not better. If you put too many foods into that tea, you're going to go anaerobic. And I could probably point to 50 articles in the scientific literature where the people were supposedly testing compost tea. There was one that just came out of Massachusetts, Morton Arboretum up there. They took 20 ounces of compost and made their gallons of, I'm not going to remember exactly correctly, but like 25 gallons of water and 20 ounces of compost. And then they put in 60 ounces of molasses per gallon of the tea. And they took that material and sprayed it out and then said, see, compost tea doesn't put any fertility back into your soil. And I was just like, oh, man. They did not make compost tea. They measured biology in their compost, and they had like 5,000 micrograms of fungi per gram of their compost. Like, wow, their compost was great. But when they got done, they had 5 micrograms of fungus in the compost tea. They went from 5,000 to 5. Well, how did they destroy all that fungi? And you just see that kind of silliness in the scientific literature over and over and over again. And, of course, when somebody does that kind of research, they're not being unbiased scientists. They're making sure that, you know, this is not going to work so that then they can say, we've tested that stuff and we've shown that compost tea doesn't work. Well, they have to actually make compost before they can say that it doesn't work.
Well, how are things on the global scale from where you sit, Elaine?
This whole biological approach is more accepted everywhere around the world except for the United States. You have to realize we live in pesticide central. So, you know, it's kind of like Ghostbuster Central, you know. Yeah.
That's where you are.
Yeah. St. Louis is the center of the storm. We work with Vandana Shiva and Navdanya, her seed-saving group, and they are doing a lot to spread this knowledge and information to growers in India. They signed those agreements with Monsanto when they used the Monsanto seeds that said you can't ever use any other seed than Monsanto, which means that these growers are being driven to bankruptcy and commit suicide. So give your land to your son or a cousin or a neighbor.
Bravo.
And then they're now out of the slavery that Monsanto put them into, and now you can reverse all of the problems. You can reverse this and start growing in a natural way. You are sustainable. You are not going to sell your soul to anybody. Vandana has the seeds that they've been saving that are not GMO. You don't have to be buying things from other companies.
That's a great piece of information you just shared about them pseudo-selling their land to get out of that contract. That's brilliant. I'm glad to hear that's going on.
And it's like philanthropists in the United States are trying to figure out what do they do about all these suicides in India. Well, buy their land and give it back to them.
Yes.
So that they get out of that slavery that they've put themselves into because they were hyped. The advertising they got sounded just too good to be true. So they signed up. Well, it was too good to be true. Indonesia, South Africa, anywhere in Africa, working with lots and lots of different projects. It gets a little overwhelming every once in a while, but where people can bring in folks that we've trained, and we've got quite a few training programs here at Rodale to help train people through the course of one growing season, a summer. Come work with us. We'll get you trained to understand how to do this, what are all the parts and pieces that you have to understand, and then go help in all these places that critically need this kind of help.
So beautiful to see that Rodale is still doing what they're doing. I mentioned Dr. Maynard Murray, who got onto the sea solid minerals. It was that same time period. Acres USA got started in that same time period. So it was a good time, and I'm glad to see that you've hooked up with them. And also you've got soilfoodweb.com that is all moving in a good direction.
And I'd like to encourage people to go to the RodaleInstitute.org, kind of keep up to date on all of the different projects. That's what we have to be doing, is getting this knowledge back into the hands of everybody growing plants.
I can't think of any more important work at this moment in time. Elaine Ingham, soilfoodweb.com, and she's at the Rodale Institute as well. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for our weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Tributaries Radio at iTunes for podcasting. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.